Hello, friends, and welcome to another edition of Turn Out of Punk Splits, where we bring together two former guests of the show that may or may not know each other. I'm your host, Damian Abraham, and today we got not one, but two great returning guests from one incredibly legendary band. Adam and Blake from Jawbreaker are back on the show. More on that in 1 second, but first, if you want to get in touch with us over here, email the email address turnedoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com. There's also TikTok, YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram pages all for Turned Out of Punk. Those can be found on Turned Out of Punk on those platforms. You can find me on Twitter or Instagram at LeftForDamian. I play in a band. We are called Fucked Up. You can find out more information over at fuckedup.cc. Just announced, we're going on tour with The Damned. Oh my God. In the East Coast in the fall, we got some stuff happening in Europe. I think we're playing Primavera and where I saw Jawbreaker, actually. We talk about that in the show a little bit. So come on out. Come out to those shows. All right, on to today's show. As I said off the top, today on the show, the legends from the band Jawbreaker, my friends Adam and Blake. Now, if you listen the last time they were on the show, Blake was on a long time ago. Adam was on a little more recently. We kind of like dove into how Jawbreaker's like a kind of unique band. They get lumped into pop punk. Some people lump them in with emo, but they kind of occupy another space. So yeah, I'm excited that I got a chance to kind of dig deeper with not one, but the two of them. If you have not seen Jawbreaker live, you have an incredible opportunity this fall in certain cities. Not everyone. Certain cities on the East Coast of the United States, and I think some of the Midwest too. You can find out more details about all those shows and where to get tickets, and also where to get your Jawbreaker records over at jawbreakerband.com. And there's some tour dates coming up. They're playing with our buddies, Joyce Manor. And so go ahead and say hi to those people. I wish I could be at those shows. And Grumpster, too, who I've not met, I don't think. But say hi to all three. Have a good time at those shows because legends. Also, check out the episode with Adam's sister, Kembra, as well, because that kind of plays into this episode too. All right, I don't think I have to ramble on anymore. Sit back, relax, and enjoy Adam and Blake on Turned Out of Punk Splits. Adam, Blake, Adam, welcome back to the show.
Great to be here. Again.
Well, I'm floored to have you both back here because, as you both are very much aware, I am a huge fan of your band, and I'm surrounded by some of your records here. I recently went to try and buy a copy of the live record. I'm like, oh, you know, what would it cost me to get a copy of the live LP? It's up to around $2,000 now. So unfortunately I don't have a copy of that lying around, but I definitely am a fan, and it's a thrill to have you back here.
Thanks. What do you think that if we repress that record that it would plummet in price, right?
I don't think so.
Is that a dick move? Like,
I don't know. Like, I think all bets are off now, right? Like, you know, you're a band, you can break up for a year and do a final tour and then get back together and do a reunion tour like a year later. And it's fair game now. You know, you can do commercials now. Like, oh, there's all these things that bands like yourselves got crucified for not even coming anywhere near close doing in terms of quote unquote selling out. And you know, now it's all fair game. So I think, yeah, the least egregious sin would be repressing this record. And I think actually people would be very grateful if you did. And I don't think it would affect the price, to be honest, because people collect records now like they collect Pokemon cards. It's no longer about music. It's about...
Right. Totally.
These are the people that have those vinyl display racks for their wall. You probably buy at IKEA.
Yep. Yeah, I got...
You can
I
have, like, your television marquee moon and, like, your germs. Right? They're, like, 8 LPs.
If you went to IKEA and got one of those things, Blake, what would you rep?
I would have to put all Swedish rock. I'd have some ABBA and some Robin.
Nice.
And, I don't know, Care Bears, whatever that band is. I don't know much.
Did you like that cover of Dancing on My Own that I sent you?
You know what? I didn't listen to it because I'm just a bad person, basically, at this point.
Terrible.
I thought you were going to say Swedish rock like the Helicopters, but man, you got some soft rock taste.
Sure, I'd put the Helicopters in there. I don't, I'm sadly, I just don't know that many. I have, that's probably the last one I know. That's three.
I feel like Sweden is a country that has definitely punched above its weight in punk stuff and metal stuff and certainly pop music, as you brought up. And I think a lot of it's to do with the fact that they had these like apparently government sponsored practice spaces and demo studios where all these bands could like just book time and kind of go down there as a community center type thing and make music. And like, look at what happened. Like this country put out everything from Entombed to Robin to Millencolin.
Right.
Millencolin, really?
Yeah.
You know, it's a culturally incredibly rich country. Some of the best detective television that's out there.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if they get free studio time order, but it's usually Swedish TV that's producing these shows, and they're the best.
Well, it's well-funded arts, right? Like, you're right. Like, they I love your Tim Hortons mug, by the way. But it's...
I'm glad you caught that. My mom sent this to me from Nova Scotia.
As you
go
know,
to Timmy's.
Yeah, as you know, Canadians are always desperate for any acknowledgement. So I appreciate the shared mug culture. We got Canadian heritage, too. But yeah, like, it's well-funded arts. You know, we have... some of it up here in Canada, but I guess nothing like they have in England or Sweden to produce this stuff. But we got better than America, though.
Yeah, we don't, we never really got, the, I don't think Jawbreaker were the, received any endowment along the way.
Well, that can come now. You know, you got, now this is your museum years.
Wasn't there like a duo from there that famously like wrote like crazy amount of like number one hit pop songs?
What are they called? It was like the people that like wrote Avril Lavigne hits, right, and stuff.
Yeah, but like for decades apparently these people were writing everything. Yeah. It seemed, I kind of caught, I didn't really,
is it called the Matrix?
Deep track.
Was it called like the Matrix or something? I don't know, that just popped in my head. There's probably like some deep obsessive Swedish pop fan right now screaming at their computer in totally. Rage that we don't know this stuff.
Yeah, let us know in the comments. Yeah. Cause you know, I love reading those comments.
It's a, I don't know. It feels like you guys though would be prepared for it. Right. Cause you had to deal with a lot of shit during the DGC time. Like that was a time when, like I said, bands were still getting crucified for these things.
We got a relatively thick skin, I think, but maybe, you know, still stings.
I think that's the thing. It stings the whole way. You know, there's people that have come on this podcast that remember bad reviews they got in 84 and like word for word, remember the bad review. Like it's stuck with them and, you can't help but sting a little bit.
Yeah, totally. I can remember a couple word for
word. Yeah. No, you remember those way better than any praise you get. I think I find this true. All my friends say the same thing. You always remember your detractors.
Because there's a kernel of truth in what they wrote about you, like that makes it hurt a little bit more, cut a little deeper.
Well, sure. Sometimes. What stuck with me were the non-committal reviews when Dear You, we did a lot of press for Dear You and like features in major newspapers. And every one of those would never say anything good or bad about the record. It was just like, they're poised to be the next thing. Big thing, question mark. This kind of coquettish, like just fucking media 101, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, and you spend like a whole day or two with this person, and you're like, oh, I see.
Yeah, and maybe even get along and, you know, have a couple of laughs, and then you go to read it later, and it's like this terribly, like, you know, it's just like this passive voice shitting on you.
Exactly. Just passive shitting. I mean, but hey, you know, at least that was like, there was some level of accountability. You could go to find the newspaper now. I can't even imagine the hatred people get just randomly online.
I think it's that. I think there's also, though, a level of, and I'm not throwing it around lightly, but like psychotic adulation that you also get online, which is probably equally unhealthy in a lot of ways. Like there's, it's almost like bands, musicians, artists, I guess YouTubers, it's become more religious levels of fanaticism. And you certainly see it in politics too, the way people look at these politicians as being sort of these infallible gods, and put them on these pedestals, or, the way people like get so fiercely loyal about bands now. Like, I feel like it feels like there, you could be a lot more passively into culture at a different time than now, where, every time you listen to a song, you're kind of like contributing to that artist in some sort of way. Or there's, these sort of like diehard fan bases that exist online. Like, it just feels like there's a, on both levels, it's kind of harder now, the hatred and the love.
Sure. Yeah.
Harder, well, because you live, there's these two worlds, and there's like the very inflated, ballooning online world that more and more people kind of exist, spend time in. And
Yeah.
then to, to coexist in both places is seems to be really challenging, especially the younger you are, kind of the rawer you are in that element.
Last time you were on the show, Blake, you mentioned starting a fire at your school, and that's why you got expelled.
True. I'm
Adam,
ready to come clean about it.
do you remember when that went down?
Yeah, I was there.
In the room? Or in the hallway, right? It
No,
was a
you're
hallway.
talking about, no, it wasn't. Are you talking about when you when we went back in the summer and there was like that, there was like a big like a sign or something up against the
That was a
building?
different case.
Oh, that was
Yeah.
it was another one.
Yeah. I've realized since, doing some self-examination that I have all the criteria of a murderer. Like I was tough on my pets when I
Oh,
was really little. I was a bedwetter and an arsonist. And like, if
the
not for
email.
punk rock, I would be probably gripping iron or underground.
Yeah, same, 100%,
Yeah,
absolutely.
we know that about you, Adam. If music hadn't intervened, you would have been in lockup for sure.
It is a place though that calls people that kind of need it that way. There's a lot of people that they come to this thing that like, where the hell would they be without this? Myself
I've heard
included.
so many people say that
Wait,
very thing.
what other fire did you set at school?
I lit the dorm on fire in Santa Cruz.
Oh, in Santa Cruz. Oh, I thought you were talking about high school because there was that what we did that high school night.
Yeah. Judgment night.
Yeah, there was like I think maybe we flooded a room too, right?
Yeah, I was expelled from the dorm at UCSC. Rich was there.
Yeah, okay. Rich came up in our talk also the last time. I
Yes.
just went and listened to like our talk because I have but like five punk rock stories. I didn't want to be redundant, so. But we mentioned Rich. He was our Red Harvest bass player.
Yes, we did talk about Rich last time. It was like a bunch of flyers that got burnt, right? That started the fire at Santa Cruz. Santa Cruz.
That's right.
But talk.
But didn't you also get thrown out of didn't we get busted also for throwing shit out the window in New York? Or was
Yeah.
that just you and Andy?
It was, well, you and I got in trouble for the pinball machine, and then it was my second offense when someone threw a
Right.
bottle out the window at a party.
That's
So
right.
then I was asked to leave.
Right. Wow.
Wow.
A lot of shenanigans.
If Jawbreaker wasn't a band, it would have been a gang.
We're kind of a gang still, though.
You
I mean,
have to be.
we'll fight, you know?
You have to be when you're out there.
You've seen the footage. We'll fight. We'll come down off stage and fight.
Yep.
Damien, you're in a gang when you're playing shows, right?
I'm a one man gang. I don't think fuck. I got beaten up at our show, and no one from Fucked Up was in this thing.
What? What
We
was
played
this?
a festival in Europe a couple years ago, and in
But
Liverpool,
you
and
got beat up a couple of years ago? What the fuck?
yeah, we've been 5 or 6 years ago now, maybe 7 years ago. And there was this group of guys fucking with this couple in the crowd, and I jumped in to the crowd and tried to get them out of there with a group of people, and then it just broke into this giant thing and ended up getting stomped. And luckily, I didn't go unconscious, so I was able to keep myself covered up. But I had like a boot print bruise right there on my face.
Oh my
And
goodness.
yeah, we finished the set. We had expanded to a 9-piece lineup for that tour and had these backup singers, and they were sobbing because I was just bleeding from the face as I'm singing the last couple songs of our set. But
Telling me there was eight people behind you watching this go down?
I don't think they saw it because it was kind of off to the side, but I think I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt on that one because no one saved me. And to make it worse, the fucking Flaming Lips were playing in the background, so I'm hearing "Do You Realize" as these guys are trying to stomp my head in.
Oh my
Where
God.
was it? What country was this in?
England.
Oh.
In Liverpool.
They know how to tussle there.
They do. Chavs. They like to fight.
Right.
But anyway, back to your criminal activity, let alone the ones that were committed against me. But Larry Livermore from Lookout Records also got into trouble for lighting a fire, but he got money from it somehow, and that's what started Lookout Records, he told me when he was on the show.
Wow.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he got like some sort of mental health diagnosis from it, and then got a small sort of welfare type thing for a
Oh,
little while.
maybe he got SSI. That was a kind of a big thing in the San Francisco punk rock world. People getting on SSI and just kind of peacing out from the workforce.
Should have gone a little further north before the fire
Wow.
started.
Well, yeah, then you would have been
I always always
McMurphy and the chief. You don't want to go too far north of that shit.
yeah. I thought Livermore started Lookout with like drug money, no?
That's what I thought too. But he's like, no. He's like, actually, it was from this, and he's admitting to something kind of also sketchy. So it's not like a better story.
Right. Or two things could be true also,
True,
right?
very true. And there is a little bit of weed in that part of the country, I've heard.
Yeah, oh boy.
You know what? We talked about it kind of, we touched on it a second ago, but there's kind of that MRR sword that cuts both ways in punk, where, like both you guys talked about how early on that was a place that people would hear about your demo, or like that was the punk news information source. But then at a certain point, it's also kind of the first place. Well, certainly the first place that I got my the first really bad review for my band. And it's almost like, I don't know, it's almost like, I guess it's not the same sort of function at this point, but for years it was this thing that would make you and then ultimately cut you off. And I guess that's the thing that kept Maximum Rock and Roll going, was the fact that it was always going to be this turnover.
Yeah, it's a yeah, well, it's a transitory place, right? Or it's I guess it's somewhere that people come and sometimes they move right through it, you know? Like there's very few people here still that were there when we arrived. Maybe a handful, but you know.
To me, it also seemed like at MRR, you kind of almost got paired with a writer if you stayed in music, and that could be a blessing or a curse. Because sometimes the writer who hated you would just stick on you and like just lambaste you. And other times you might have a champion within the city. Like we were treated pretty kindly for MRR, like we did not fit the bill.
Yeah.
So I'd say we got off very lightly because
Well,
they.
because Lance was in there writing reviews and stuff, and we had Ben Weasel was doing columns and singing our praises until he wasn't. But yeah, you're right. I think we got it was pretty kid gloves on us until 90, the fall of 95, I guess.
Right. And we kind of aged out of it too. Like why would they didn't need to write about us. We just weren't in their world really,
Yeah.
musically. It was so
Well,
into kind of aggressive confrontational music. And here we were trying to find our voice and be artists. like that didn't really have a place in that zine.
Right.
I don't know. Like I push back on that a little bit because it did have that kind of focus on that aggressive music, but then it also had, you know, like I read about Yourselves, or I'd read about like I'm at a loss now. Diesel Queens is a totally different type of band, but they did cover anything that was related to punk, and I think that's what shaped my kind of view on this music. That as long as it somehow connects back to this thing, it's part of this thing, and it doesn't necessarily have to sonically sound like one type of version of it.
That's true. I mean, a lot of experimental industrial noise, there was some really far out stuff in there. I just feel like kind of on the poppier songwriting end of the spectrum, it, under Tim's rubric of like, it must be ready for, you know, war. Like, there was a kind of outline, like you've got to be really contentious. That could have been my personal take on it.
No, I think you're right on that, because it's almost like there's an assumption by a certain segment of punk that any melody is going for it, and any pursuit of songwriting is searching for commercial acceptance.
Right.
Like,
dude, I'm just trying to figure my own self out. Like, to me, melody is just a means to resolution within my troubled heart. I like, it's like people who are into math, I think, who like the beauty of an equation. To me, finishing a song is like completing an equation, not in the algorithmic, you know, Scooter Braun, whatever this world is now, but like it helps you heal when you've round the last corner. You're like, yeah, that's where it stops. It began there. It climaxed here and it ended here.
And I think it's with punk right from the beginning. Like, I think hardcore is when there's a break, because there's like this sort of further refinement and sort of this idea that, like, you know, it has to be aggressive, it has to be faster than the thing before it, it has to be, you know, harder.
I just remember always, like, it was always the more melodic stuff that landed with me, that spoke to me, you know. Like, even with a band that's as fast and aggressive as, like, say, I'm thinking of like an LA like Social Distortion or Channel 3, or like, it was always like the stuff I put on mixtapes was always the most melodic stuff that those guys had to offer, you know. So I never looked at it like it was a bad thing, you know, or not punk. I mean, you know, I came up on the Clash and the Buzzcocks, and we came up on all that SST stuff, and like a lot of that stuff, like Meat Puppets, is very melodic and not punk at all.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think we were maybe a little earlier in our formation, but it was really interesting to see kind of post-hardcore. Like, I remember playing with Heroin. We did a few shows with Heroin, San Diego, Isla Vista, and up in maybe
Petaluma.
Okay, yeah, that's right, with Spitboy. But yeah, seeing that Gravity kind of scene emerge, I don't know if they were on Gravity, but you know, that yeah, like post-punk, post-hardcore, just like, I loved it. Like, it was, because it was such a new kind of way of playing, and just seeing everything get blown out kind of into real chaos. It was cool because it was totally a new way of playing. Mm. And into kind of Jehu, I guess, where you're just getting that both melodic and like completely untethered.
Yeah, I was just going to bring that up, actually. It's funny that you mentioned Jehu.
San Diego doesn't really get talked about in the way that Seattle does, but to me, it's like way more interesting stuff kind of comes out of that after Seattle. Like, you look at the same time you got that Heroin, Gravity record stuff popping off, you're like, you got that Jehu, Rock from the Crypt stuff happening, you've got like kind of Unbroken happening, and you have Blink-182 stuff happening. It's all kind of at the same time, in the same place, in the same like tiny little scene, and like all the places that would go and all the people that stuff would influence in different ways. But
yeah, they know that there's a documentary you may have seen about kind of San Diego music scene. It's on YouTube. It's really great.
I gotta see.
It has
this.
A lot of Truman's Water, Three Mile Pilot. It really gets into everybody. Sadly, Fluff. There's no O in there, but there is kind of Josh from Fluff has a headshot in there. Well, talking cool. about what's really interesting is Ian MacKay, and because he's in every punk rock documentary, has this great point about like how he felt it was the cities in the shadow of the other cities.
Yeah,
but kind of San Diego living under Los Angeles created this shadow where this really rich, unself-conscious kind of music scene could foment and like turn into this just explosion, which was really rad.
Yeah, people shit on San Diego. It's like, it's the Padres, you know, it's not the Dodgers. It's a military town. It's a border town. People shit on it all the time.
And it's, but it's also a very posh and conservative town politically.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Kind of ripe for like an insurgency, you know, or just people doing who are like, I don't want to do this. I want to create something, an alternative to this.
Yeah, yeah. So certainly there was some pushback on that. Like I remember the Shea Cafe? Remember playing the Shea
Cafe?
Oh,
yeah, totally.
There's the Gilman of San Diego, kind of.
Yeah, totally.
Such a cool spot.
Yeah, and the Casbah too, right?
Casbah, for sure.
Yeah, we were always really well received down there. That was like a major stop for us.
Yeah, so for sure.
Always big shows with great local bands, and like people just came out.
I think we played the very last. Someone just sent me. I think Anthony Liu just sent me a flyer from Pitchfork's very last show, and it was us and Pitchfork. Because I was trying to remember if we had played with Jehu, and we hadn't. But we had played with Pitchfork and certainly like Hot Snakes, you know.
Oh, that's awesome. You know, you brought up, I guess we could say rest in peace to a bunch of people right now from San Diego. But you brought up Fluff, and I can't believe I didn't bring up Fluff. But O seems like one of the people that did unite all these little scenes. Like he's someone who I think, you know, like just loved this kind of music so much. But he's like recording the Blink-182 stuff at the same time that he's recording like Rocket stuff early on. He's going to check out Heroin shows, and he's like in all these different seemingly separate universes.
Yeah, omnivorous fan of the scene.
Yeah, he was like the Lance Hahn of San Diego, you know. He was just everywhere. And yeah. Both of those guys are kind of like Zelig, because you'll be just looking through archival photographs of them and like, oh yeah, of course, there's O right in the front, you know, or there's O, you know, in Trans World, or there's O working with, you know, Big Daddy Roth or whatever, you know, he's just everywhere.
Yeah. I think
he's really, I mean, I'm still like, I still, there's O-isms that I still use to this day, just because they're just ingrained. There's part of my DNA now.
And me too.
And Olive Lawn were fucking awesome.
We played with Olive Lawn in at Spanky's in Riverside really early on. Yeah.
Yeah. There's just like so many unbelievable bands, that kind of come out of like, I guess all these kind of like places, but it's interesting how a lot of it is reaction to like the scene getting too violent that existed before, and kind of like people being driven out and kind of splintered into different places. Like you see it happening in LA, you know, like I think the rise of that sort of country punk stuff, and even the Paisley Underground stuff, and just the kind of like artier SST stuff, like all that seems to get kind of a push from all these people kind of fleeing these shows that were just getting too violent and too scary.
Yeah. Yeah, God, you're just reminding me of like Tex and the Horseheads and Blood on the Saddle and all those, and you know, Geraldine Fibbers and all those kind of cool bands.
Yeah. And Dwight Yoakam was playing with some of those bands too, right? Like,
you know, I just had a Dwight Yoakam epiphany of State, New York. I was camping, or I'm not going to use that word, rented a cabin. With a friend, and it came with a record player and some
Dwight Yoakam.
But we really were. We were like a really luxury cabin And there were these Dwight Yoakam records there, so we were playing them. And that guy is amazing. I loved his acting. I knew him more as an actor.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew he was like Twin Cities, punk rock kind of, I think, like he would play with Husker Du and stuff back in the day. I mean, be on bills with them.
Yeah, like he definitely went to L.A. and like there's flyers with him playing with the Blasters. And he talked about going to see Black Flag play back then and really getting into that scene at that time. It's there's like all sorts of like Katie Lang. Katie Lang was a punk up in Saskatchewan back in
you
the
can
day.
Tell.
You can tell.
The haircut, the like, I mean, just the best style.
Yeah.
It could only come from a kind of a punk rock queer background. Like, you have that chop, you know, Twin Peaks kind of Asian Cooper, like the Dale Cooper look. So
yeah.
Rad.
Yeah. It's kind of like a great, like, not to overly idealize punk because there's a lot of terrible shit with it too, but at the same time, it's a place where you're going to find so many interesting people coming out of it because it's one of the few places you can go as someone that doesn't fit in. And there's a lot of people that don't fit in.
Yeah. I'm always shocked when I, you know, I'll tune into the podcast and be like, oh shit, really? Them? They're a punk rocker. It's so cool.
I find you can tell now, like just anytime I like anyone and I find anyone interesting, I'm like, there's going to be something. There's going to be like some weird little connection to things, you know?
Totally.
It even actually when Jack Black was on, he was dropping all this stuff. And I went back and re-listened to the episode and actually started researching stuff. And I'm like, my God, there was stuff that he was dropping that just wasn't on my radar because he was much more of like an SST kind of cult type thing, which seems like that was like a little separate subsect of things. Like SST is kind of its own world. Do you ever see a band called Mustard in LA?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. They went to our high school.
Wait, you guys went to that high school too?
With Jack. Yeah.
Oh shit. That's crazy. And Maya Rudolph went there too.
Yep. That dog. A lot of folks.
Yeah.
Yeah. All the Hayden kids went there. I thought we talked about this in the episode. No,
no.
Oh, I thought for sure we hit on that.
No, we didn't talk about this at all because now you're blowing my fucking mind. Cause I know like all I researched Mustard and then Mustard became Hedgehog and then Hedgehog was on HG. Yeah. And Hedgehog was on HG Fact out of Japan and Fucked Up did a record on HG Fact. So that's how I connect to this whole little world, but this is blowing my mind. Oh, you guys are connected. That's fucking crazy.
Daryl Goldfarb.
Yeah.
And the Treacherous Jaywalkers, yep. James Fenton and Josh Hayden. They were an SST. I think they did an album for SST. They were
at
our
school. I think they did two. They might have done two. And Quinn Haber. Yeah. We know all those guys.
So was
they
like.
They were a couple years younger than us, but always playing music.
So was like SST huge in your high school? Because it seems like there was a lot of kids with connections to that kind of world.
It was a small group, but that was the label. I felt like that was our, we felt like it was our local label. Cause at the time, like when we were going to show, when I was, and Adam and I were going to shows together, I felt like the Minutemen played every other weekend and you'd have Slovenly or like those kind of lower tier SST bands.
Yeah.
Who were all really interesting, but yeah. DC nine, you know.
DC3.
Yeah, look, those kind of projects were happening all over the place.
And like that's the interesting thing too, because for me, prior to like, there was always a different quality of Jawbreakers music. Like you could always, it didn't sound like you guys would have fit in on Fat Records or Epitaph. You know, there was like something different to your music. But it wasn't really till I talked to you guys that I realized like how much of your musical DNA is kind of the same musical DNA that goes into like Sonic Youth or Dinosaur Jr. or like that SST world or that kind of, I don't know, like Steel Pole Bathtub too, like who you brought up last time, like that, I would put them in that too. Like it's a much more, I don't want to say like intelligent version of punk, but it is like kind of like a more artier and a more kind of like let's leave it an artier approach to things.
I can, yeah, I can see that.
Well, I think in our case too, it was film. I mean, I know with you, Adam brought in tons of samples from old movies or just favorite movies, and like trying to figure out how to make your own sampler, you know, which was a real technical challenge for us. Mike from Steel Pole taught me their trick, which was just to have a power strip and a tape recorder plugged into it that was playing, and he would kick on the power strip whenever they wanted their sample to play. So then the little, you know, flat tape recorder would start playing, and that was mic'd or directed, direct outputted.
Yep.
We tried that for a bit. It was a total nightmare. Like, you unplug it every time you get psyched. But, you know, a little MacGyver action. It's pretty rad.
I guess that's why, like, bands like Mission of Burma had someone in charge of tape loops. Because you kind of do need someone just to be there, just to flick that power bar button. It's easier to do with your finger than your foot.
Yeah. Well, now we do. Now we trigger our samples either from the front of house or from monitors, and yet still our method is totally like anachronistic, right? It's what's that machine that we use, Blake? It's like no one makes that thing anymore. It's so not what
it's a looper. Do. Yeah, it's one of those early looper pedals. You could store like 99 samples in it. So yeah, it works.
Yeah, exactly.
It works. Sometimes it goes sideways, and sometimes that's great too.
That's I like. And now I realize, like, when shows go sideways or something happens at a show, and it's not perfect, those are what I want to see happen. Like, not
the best.
Yeah, because, you know, as a musician, it sucks to go through it as you're living through it. But I think as like a fan, like to know that you were there for that unique version of that event is like, it's awesome.
Yeah, those are my favorite moments. Like, nothing's more boring than a show that goes off without a hitch, you know?
My favorite
is when we all three are completely off. Like, that's where I love it most. Because we inevitably will get back to the one together, but I find it hysterical while it's happening. Like, it's not a nightmare for me. I think it's hilarious.
I've only gotten to see you guys play the one time, or twice now. But I remember the time in Primavera, and Blake, you had sunscreen running into your eyes throughout the whole set. And it became kind of a narrative to the show. You know, like, obviously, you're there for the songs, but I also love that the fact that you do have this sort of narrative arc to the story, to the show that's being told throughout the thing about...
It's nice that when you find a little line for just one show, a narrative, you know, be it sunscreen or like some imaginary peeve you have. I love when people on the mic do that, kind of create a thread just for that event.
I remember going on tour with like a big band, and they're playing like some big stadium thing, and we're opening, and the same night, every night, they're saying the same shit on stage. And I was like, God. You know, but now I'm like,
I saw that really recently. Cause I went to three show. I went, saw a band that they were playing three nights in a row. And the first time they had a little spiel that I was like, oh, that's cool. What a cool little moment there that I was privy to. And then they did it again.
Same
part of the set. Like it, and then they did it, I think, a third time maybe. And it kind of soured me on them.
But you can't help but do it, right? Like, you're up there every night. Like Blake's saying, you got to find something. If you don't have a narrative arc to kind of fill that space in between songs.
Yeah, but all the guy would have had to have done was say, yeah, I mentioned this last night, but ... Like, just say that.
Yeah.
Don't try to make it like it's just coming out of the clear blue sky.
I want to say something here too.
Please.
I go live every show.
That is
I've never repeated my shtick, and I don't plan anything. For the little parts where I talk, it's always on the fly, for better or worse. If I'm having a bad time, I might say nothing. It sucks. But I've never scripted a gig. I might think a little bit about the theme of that evening. Little callback for the boys in the band, you know, like something we were joking about that day. But just gonna say that, I'm putting that out there, right?
It's true. I could verify that. Because I'll even like before the show, I'll go up to Blake and go like, yo, it's so and so's birthday. You should give him a shout out. And he never does it.
I never do it. But it will really only because I completely go blank when we start. It's not like anti that person's birthday. It's just like I have no idea what's no. You kind of do go blank when you get up there.
Yep, 100%.
Blake will go blank. I'll call him back to the kit and I'll go, yo, it's so and so's birthday. And he turns around and walks 10 feet and he's forgotten it already.
I relate. I fucked up someone's wedding proposal because I forgot to do it in the middle of our show. Like you said, Blake, you're up there, you gotta focus, right? Like, if you stop believing you can fly for a second when you're up there, you crash to the ground. Like, it's hard.
Yeah,
How do you
for
remember?
sure. And a lot
How do
of
you
words
remember
to
the
keep you
words? Like,
going.
right?
Poorly, poorly, for my case.
I have to stay blank to keep the words in order, or do the kind of method thing of like really let go in order to grab hold. When I, you know, we, I'm sure you have this, Damien, but Chris and I talk about this all the time. Like, if you ever start thinking about a part that's coming up that you're worried about, you're gonna blow it.
100%.
I have to not, I have to pull that worry out ahead of it coming down the line so I can get it.
It's like it is the that's the art to it, is like getting up there and clearing your head. And like you're saying, you can kind of like express that you're having a bad time in between the songs, but when you're performing those songs, you got to put the bad time out of your head. Otherwise, those songs are just not going to happen. And there have been only a handful, thankfully, but a couple shows where it's just completely crashed and burned for us.
Do you have a ritual that do you like have a warm-up ritual or like a kind of a clear your head ritual before you play?
Smoke as much weed as possible.
Real interesting.
Yeah. I find if I can float on stage, that's my ideal. But I think that's just like you find your thing, right? Like, how many weird shit things that I try not to lose my voice. I mean, you must have been told like a million things over the years, Blake, like not to lose your voice. Like, oh, drink loquat honey, or don't drink any sugar, or drink sardine oil, or like all this sort of crazy stuff that you're supposed to do. But if you get relaxed, you're not going to blow out your voice.
Yeah, I mean, as I've gotten older, I find really trying to pace yourself is a huge part of the plan that works. Like, you want to come out strong, but it, like, I find if I can keep it at 85% for the first 20 minutes, I'll have that 15% when I need it at the back end.
I wanted to ask you about this last time, but I forgot to ask you. But did you guys ever see Joe Coleman? Speaking about performers that just let it go completely.
No, I know. Yeah, I know him by name.
There's a video online of the first Voluptuous Horror of Karen Black show, and Joe Coleman's kind of like the MC throughout. It blows himself up and does all that kind of stuff. But those are the people that really inspire me. Like, your sister, Joe Coleman, like these performers that go out there and just let it all go and can just completely immerse themselves in that performance. And that's the dream, to like be able to go out there and just like forget that audience and just be the performance.
Just blow it up literally like Coleman did.
Yeah.
I
Still
went I
plays.
spent a day I spent a day with him and my sister in Echo Park. We took a paddle boat ride on the lake and he was showing me that he had filed his teeth down to enable him to more easily bite the heads off of mice for his live shows.
What
And
year
I
was
put,
this?
it was probably in the like the low 80s or something. And I go, what do you do for your day job? Don't think he dug it.
Think you had to have a day job in New York at that point, it seems, right? Like, it
No,
was so cheap.
for sure not.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
I was just talking to someone about Gigi Allen. I never saw Gigi Allen. Did you guys ever see Gigi Allen play?
I didn't. No.
No.
I mean, it really made me wonder, because I know his legend, you know, which precedes him, obviously. But, like, it made me wonder what kind of person he was, like, in just regular life, you know. Was he completely insane? Was he totally unhinged? Or was he, like, that's just his night job? I don't know.
I think that was the thing you heard about, like, that, you know, that first Gigi Allen comeback show when he gets out of prison, and like Thurston Moore's in the band and Jay Mask is in the band, and they've got, like, you know, kind of this like sort of star studded band together for Gigi to play his songs. And I think everyone thought it was all just a joke, and thought it, because like there was no internet, right? There's no YouTube to see these performances. So unless you're a Gigi Allen fan with tapes, you're just like hearing about it word of mouth or reading about it in Flipside or MRR. And apparently that first show back, everyone realized very quickly, like, this is not a joke. This guy is for real scary.
Yeah. And that's, it's been a while since I saw that documentary. Did Todd Haynes make that?
Todd Phillips.
Phillips, excuse me.
Yeah, Todd, it hated the, there's, that's also, right. And I think on the DVD version, there's a video of after the show of just Gigi, you know, walking throughout the Lower East Side, I guess, trying to escape police that have come or whatever, covered in shit and blood. And he keeps trying to get into these cabs, and the cab drivers won't pick him up. But at one point, this total, like, I see as Upper West Side art couple comes running up to Gigi, and they're like, Kevin, Kevin. And they've got like their small child with them, and they give their small child to Gigi, gives them a kiss on the cheek, and he's like talking to them. So, you know, Gigi's a guy. Wow. He existed in two worlds, right? Like, he was an art dude too.
Yeah, amazing.
Your sister must have been around him or seen him, right? Like,
it's, no, I think, like, I think she knew him, sure. Yeah.
Because it's kind of the same world, weirdly. It like overlaps, I guess, a bit.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure she knew him because he was also in the Lower East Side, right?
Yeah, the terrifying Lower East Side that you discussed going to back then.
Yeah,
drug buckets were raining from the sky.
Yeah,
it's weird how punk always winds up being, though, the thing that ruins all these, not maybe not ruins, but changes all these neighborhoods. You know, like the A7's down there, and all these punk places are down there. Or look at the neighborhood around the Gilman, or look at any number of places that have had great punk venues in them at different times in different cities, or a lot of punks around there. And now it's just sort of condos and chain stores.
I think that's just the world now.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess you're right. Like, I guess it's everywhere. And I guess it's been also the leveling that's happened, where every city seems very much like a mall at this point, and very similar.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's the curse of the creative class too, to be that early wave of gentrification So they have accountability in it too, in the grand realty, kind of capital realty scheme. But they break ground in those places, soften them up, and then developers follow eventually. And you're constantly being displaced as you displace people with less for you. I mean, that was our story in the Mission, right?
Like, totally.
It was where we could afford to live in that city. And then, you know, I just read a book called How to Kill a City, which is a great study of like four cities in America and how that story replays itself in every metropolis. And the kind of the strategy of gentrification, as I learned it, was to bleed an area dry, get all the residents to move out, and then occupy it. And
it seems like what happened in New York. You know, you hear talked about in documentaries and things like that, where you just had this sort of complete bankrupting of infrastructures in the city. So you just drove people out and buildings were literally being just set on fire. And then at that point you could buy up that real estate super cheap and redevelop it. You see it, like, look at Brooklyn waterfront. It seems like anywhere Vice had an office in the last 20 years.
Oh, God. You know, we were like, this is crazy, but in Forgetters, we practiced in the Death by Audio building. And I think Vice is now there. The people who build the Death by Audio pedals were up above, and then they had this rehearsal habit trail maze of like chopped up this big industrial space that was cut into like 150 rooms. Every like scrappy band in Brooklyn was practicing. It was just like 100.
Was that right near the river? Was that really close to the water?
Yeah.
In Williamsburg though.
Yes. I remember that spot, 'cause I think we practiced there once.
But you know, then 5 years later, it's like everyone got evicted and it came. Yeah. Good point about Vice though.
And I think Vice moved out today. You know, like that's the ultimate irony, is like even the stuff that comes in afterwards is going to get wiped out, you know, and it's just going to be condos, or it's just going to be big box retailers. And it's just going to be, you know, like, because you can't stop gentrification at a point, right? Like it's just going to keep going. And so Vice managed to gentrify themselves out of the office space eventually.
Let me tell you something as a Canadian on that subject. Thanks for Gavin McGinnis.
Also Jordan Peterson.
Yeah. But was he living in the States now?
I don't know. I got to be honest. I'm not trying to keep tabs on either of them, but Gavin.
Not a Google alert for JP.
Well, no, I'm definitely trying to hear his
lead. Make your bed, Damien. Make your bed.
I'm worried. Yeah. I'm worried I'm talking about it right now that's going to pick up on my algorithm on all my social medias. I'm going to have to put up with more of his fucking ridiculous bullshit showing up. But Gavin's real directly out of Canadian punk, sadly. You know, like he was a Ottawa, Five Arlington going to show type kid, you know, going to these little punk shows in this basement, and some wire got crossed on the way, and whatever happened. Well, actually, no, I know what happened. Are you familiar with Answer Me Fanzine?
Sure.
You remember, it was a, you know, the fanzine from the 90s. Jim Goad, who wrote that fanzine, put that fanzine out. That's like Gavin's like ideologue. Like that is the guy that Gavin just modeled himself after and sort of gave rise to the Gavin McGinnis character that we know today, as opposed to the Gavin McGinnis character that used to exist, where it was like, you know, a guy who identified, I think, as a communist even at one point, certainly as a socialist, and was in a band with people that would wind up in Godspeed You Black Emperor, you know, like certainly not this path. But yeah, apologies for that. We've got,
I want to know how he slipped through the net of the whole J6 roundup. Like the Proud Boys crackdown, like he pretty deftly sidestepped that whole dragnet as a founder, right? Like zero accountability.
I think it's gonna, well, who knows when all those nets are gonna finish dropping on all those people. But yeah, it was weird seeing who was there, and kind of terrifying to see, who was there from different, like, you know, the actor that was on Mr. Show or people.
Oh, yeah.
Indie rock bands. Well, back on to more pleasant subjects.
Yeah, sorry. I feel like we got a little bit off track.
Believe me, this is the splits. It's splits. It's just open. We can talk about anything and whatever. We don't have, it's no longer me punishing just about your punk journey. Now we're just rambling, hanging. Last time, I think actually, Adam, you told me this. Blake, you kept a copy of Husker Du's New Day Rising in your locker at school?
I was so excited about that record that I didn't want to leave it at home. So I brought it to school with me just so I would be near it.
They are one of the greatest bands of all time, obviously, but it's just amazing how, you know, talk about melody and the search for melody. Like, they were a band that I think very early on in hardcore realized that it didn't have to be about divorcing it from melody. You could find a way to bring melody back into it.
You know what I find fascinating about that band now, especially, is Bob Mould, like, his voice and his guitar had the same kind of distortion. He somehow had this perfectly distorted voice and that, like, completely blown out guitar sound was just like, only his guitar in Husker Du sounds like that, like so distorted, not overdriven, not fuzz, but like, just, I don't know. There's something very akin and like whole about what he brought, that dimension. Bob Mould is just this column, this pillar of distortion and melody, you know?
I wonder if it's from trying to, you know, like in practice where you don't have a good PA, you certainly don't have monitors. So you're trying to sing over your amp. So you could hear yourself a little bit. Like, I wonder if that's, cause you're right. Like, there is a quality to his voice where there's like a distortion to it. And it's like, maybe it's from trying to, like, I know from being a vocalist, struggling to hear myself in practices, and given how loud that band was famously, I imagine a little tiny jam space that must've been, you know, you need inner ears.
Do you use those now?
No.
Yeah, I can't, I cannot.
It'd be weird. It would feel, you know, but our we also have like one guitar player that's obnoxiously loud, like to the point where people in the front row sometimes will complain to me, like, can you tell him to turn down? It's like, I've been telling him to turn down for 23 years. He's not going to start now. getting back together now at this point for you guys, does it feel like there's like a different sort of way of communicating with each other, and there's like a different way of understanding each other than when you guys were together the first time?
It is environmentally different. We all live in different cities, so it's like automatically couldn't be further from what it was. But I think when we're playing, it actually feels pretty familiar. I know from our prep sessions, like before Riot Fest, it took about a week really to get in there, but then it was kind of like, oh yeah, we're the same in the room together. Is that too vague?
Stage is definitely the same.
It's interesting because at a certain point, if your band's together long enough, you've been a band longer than you would have been friends before being in the band. So at that point, the band becomes the relationship in a certain way, and it almost becomes, yeah, like something where you can just get up there and do it. And no matter what the situation is between people before the hand on at the show, you can kind of get up there and still come together for the project.
Right. Yeah, I mean, when me and Blake talk nowadays, like if we have a conversation on the phone, it's very rare that we even bring up the band stuff. Usually we're just talking shit about films or books or music or, you know, gossip. But we don't really talk about the band.
Yeah, it's kind of a Chinese wall, I think. You need a little bit to keep your personal and your performing lives intact. I mean, because we all have friendships too. Like we did start as, we started as a band and friends with Chris. We met Chris via the band, but we all hung out. I think as you do it longer, you do have to figure out, like, you've got to partition your lives to make it doable. And yeah, I think we kind of keep the friendship side, and then there's the, you know, you got to get your shit together. No, I'm just joking. There isn't really that, but there is the, like, we got to learn these parts and have it together.
Yeah, I guess I'm still learning that part of it, like to maintain the friendship side of things, because it's hard, because the working together side, like the, you know, and even though you're joking, the get your shit together side of things of being in a band can't help but spill over, like the negative review. I don't know.
Well, yeah, certainly in a band, if one person's got a problem, everybody's got a problem.
Yeah.
You know, you're all tied in that way.
Yeah.
So, it teaches you a lot. I think it really does teach you. Certainly having, I mean, I know this, working with men, which is seems to be from back in the day, historically kind of the bane of the rock bands. Environment, working place, you know, how to work with men and not go brain dead. And I mean this, and I'm not casting aspersion on anyone, but I felt it a lot in just Brazil. We'd be touring and all these guy bands we were playing with, there was just all men playing for the most part in the kind of post emo circuit or whatever circuit I was on.
And right.
You just see these groups of men that just didn't know how to talk to each other than in very coded kind of safe ways. And you could almost tell which bands were going to fall apart or were going to just like put their heads down and just grind it, you know? And it was haunting, honestly. It just felt really like inert, not like fun or not creative. And I don't know. So if you do it a long time, you have to figure out how to relate to one another as human beings. And we're lucky in that we have three people who are all pretty unique. You know, I'm going to say it, man, non-suburban, you know, urban people. I'm becoming an elitist. I don't know if you know this.
Yeah. Well, you're glamping now, so.
I'm an East Coast elite, so.
Glamping East Coast elite.
Glamping. My way into retirement. That's right.
But you find these chemistries that just work, you know, like both of you have been in other bands, and I don't know, like maybe you did find chemistries that felt the same as Jawbreaker to you, but well, here you are in Jawbreaker. So I guess it wasn't the same, you know, there's just something about the three of you that came together that just, you know, like it still works. If you guys are still friends and able to still do this, you know, like that's something special. Like, it, you know, you can search a whole lifetime and not find that. Going back to the SST kind of world and that kind of sound of things, were those shows kind of like where you saw yourselves going with Jawbreaker? Like, was that kind of like, you know, prior to like sort of the scene that would emerge, the alternative scene, was it like, when you're doing that band in New York, where you're like, we'll go back to LA, we'll wind up signing to SST.
I think that was the closest thing we could see doing. I mean, we actually played there, but we went to the Anti Club all the time. Not a great place, but great consistent SST bills. And I think it was, I don't know, Adam, you would know, but it was like our second or third show, wasn't it?
At Anti?
Yeah. Or did it take us longer? It was an achievement, I know, when we played there. When we paid to play there.
Yeah. No, it was... let me look. Yeah, it was one of our earlier things. Yeah, for sure.
That's LA, though, right? Pay-to-play shows.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
We have to sell tickets to your friends. You know, it's maybe $200 worth of tickets, so they'd be guaranteed that 30, 40 people are going to show up and buy their liquor, I guess.
Yeah.
Interestingly, beautiful little footnote here. The booker or managers daughter was E.G. Daly of Valley Girl.
Yeah, I think it was. I think it was her mom owned the club, actually.
Her, yeah. So we were always like hoping that E.G. would stop by, you know, just to get a glimpse.
Yeah. If you want my love, say it, say it.
Right.
I think that's the thing about Los Angeles, too. There's also like so much glitz so close by with Hollywood. Like there's always, it seems like not as stratified as maybe it is, but like it just seems like there's always some weird Hollywood connection.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. I mean, they're out there living. So you're going to cross paths and inevitably.
Well, yeah. And also we, you know, the people that we were hanging out with at school, like we went to a school that had like a lot of like people that were in, like they were all into, like, you know, it's like an industry town. So our school was very, there was just like everyone, you know, every other person seemed to be, you know, their father or mother was like a, you know, from the movies or TV or something. And a lot of those kids and a lot of their kids were just like, just punk rock kids, you know?
Yeah. And I guess that's a natural rebellion, right? Like, it's, you know, if your parents have found, you know, success in whatever their field is, like, and you want to find, carve your own way, punk is the perfect place to do it.
I think, you know, sometimes it came from the parents too, because they were young and hip enough to be in the LA art scene. I mean, I know one of our best friends, Laura, her mom was a costume designer for films, and she was friends with Lee Ving because she did Get Crazy. And like, there were punks in the house coming by to hang out. So it was kind of like handed down to the children, you know, oh, you should go see Lee's band. They're really fun. Or,
yeah, she did
kind of groovy.
Streets of sense. Fire, too, right?
Laura Norton, Rosanna Norton.
Yeah, I think she did Streets of Fire because I remember that Lee Ving and Willem Dafoe were like hanging out at her house.
Right. Together?
Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, I guess Fear's like, you know, even on the East Coast with doing the Saturday Night Live thing. Well, I guess they knew John Belushi probably from Hollywood.
Right.
He had moved out there by that point.
Yeah. I mean, Lee is so charismatic. It was like, that made so much sense to me that he would end up as a character actor. It's like a kind of De Niro vibe, you know, it's very streetwise. And
yeah.
The wild.
He always reminded me of that kid, the kid in the Dead End Kids. You remember like the lead guy in the Dead End Kids or the Bowery Boys?
The comedy group, the Bowery Boys?
No, it was like they did, it was like a serial thing. Like, and they did some feature length motion pictures, and like I think they were around in the 30s to the 50s. I think
I thought it was like a Little Rascals-y type thing,
kind of, yeah, but they were a little bit older, they were like a little bit more rough and tumble, they were like, you know, teenagers.
Okay,
I can't remember his name, but he always reminded me of Lee Ving.
the other day I heard this demo from 93. And it's a Fear lineup with Josh Freese on drums, Scott Thunes, I think his name is, who was the bass player for Frank Zappa, and the guitar player from Atomic Rooster. And it fucking shreds.
I just saw Fear play last, or maybe 2 years ago, at Riot Fest. And Spit Sticks was playing drums.
Oh, yeah.
And they were amazing. And yeah. I actually went up to Spit Sticks and I was like, I hate to be that guy, but I think I need a pair of drumsticks. And I got them. They're sitting right over there.
I mean, that's awesome that you're still like that. I definitely feel like there's lots of times that I wish I had done that now. And I'm like, fuck, I wish I had brought a record to get signed by this person, or, you know. Or ask them for the set list or something.
I have a one sheet movie poster for X the Unheard Music. It says play this movie loud, and it's got the big X red against a black background. And I'm like, I always because there's been so many opportunities that I could bring it and get those guys to sign it. I haven't done it yet because that's, I don't know, it might be a bridge too far. to show up with like a fucking poster and just be like,
hey. If you showed up with 20 posters, or you know, that's different. But I think one, especially something that cool, no, you got to do that.
I know. I should have done it.
There'll be other opportunities. I think you're in the same kind of general world.
Let me ask you guys a question. Speaking of X, I have this problem where whenever I'm watching a movie with Patty Considine, I'm sure it's John Doe.
Wait, which one is he?
He's an Irish actor who looks like John Doe. He was in The Girl with All the Gifts, and like he was in America. Yeah.
That's a good call, man.
Dude, I was like on IMDb, like, wow, I didn't know John Doe was in this. Patty Considine. Just keep that, plant that in your mind the next time.
No, I get it. I can see it right now because I can see the poster for In America right now.
It's but awesome.
I mean, not for nothing, John Doe's doing fine. I mean, he just made DOA. And yeah, I heard that was really great. I don't know. I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, I want to see it. He was talking about it last time he was on the show. But yeah, he's someone who, you know, just has it. You know, has that look, has got that Hollywood, you know, charm.
Yeah. I mean, you saw it in Decline, like, you know, everything.
I wanted to ask you, like, you brought up Screeching Weasel and Ben Weasel specifically way back when. And I kind of think like both Jawbreaker and Screeching Weasel were two bands that were at least presented to someone like me as a fan as being like heir apparent to like the next band that's going to do it. And obviously you guys take different paths and pursue it different ways, but neither one of you really seems to go for it. Like, I know you guys signed a DGC, but at the same time, it's not like, you know, you're doing the Warped Tour and you're like really leaning into that world. Was that a conscious thing, or were you trying to pursue it in that sort of way? Or did you want to make it on your own terms? And if it wasn't going to happen on your own terms, it wasn't going to happen.
I'm not sure the Warped Tour was even a thing when we were a band, was it?
You know, like Lollapalooza. Were you like...
Well, no one ever asked us to go play Lollapalooza. We probably would have done it. I mean, especially if it was like with, you know, fucking Ice-T, we would have been all over the thing.
Yeah, I don't think we were asked to play Warped either. I don't know that we would have done it. It definitely wasn't our... We were kind of like snooty. Little bit, you know, like we wouldn't want to go to play with a bunch of jabronis.
Yeah, we probably had a little bit of that. We had a little bit of a chip on our shoulder. Like, I remember thinking, and I might have mentioned this last time we spoke, but like they offered us what was it? Oh, Beavis and Butthead do America. And we were like, nah, we're not gonna do that. Looking back, like, big mistake. I think it would have been great to be on that. but at the time, we were like, no, we're not going to do that. You know, we just fucking sold out. Like, let's not just take the first thing that's offered. You know, that's going to be a bad look. We're still going to play our shows. They're going to be $8. We're going to go out and play with our friends. It's going to be all the same, except maybe we'll sell some more records or something. So we try to kind of keep it lean and mean still, you know.
Well, yeah, like, you know, minus those radio shows that you talked about last time, you're not really playing the game. Like, there's a certain way to do this thing that's like, you got to play by their rules and do agree to all the things. And that's the way, you know, and it still might not work out, but that's the way to play this.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that said, the things that they did offer us that were compelling to us, we did, you know, we did all those radio shows, and I'm glad about that because we got to watch Oasis and Radiohead, you know, that week or whatever, that run of shows, and stoked. I'm so stoked that we did that tour in Australia with the Beasties and Sonic Youth and Rancid and Bikini Kill and Pavement and Beck. Like, everyone was on that show. It was crazy. So we weren't totally adverse to it, but we were pretty selective, you know. Like, if we were fans, we would do it. But if we didn't give a shit about what was going on, we wouldn't stoop.
Wait, was that a big day out festival in Australia?
It was called Somersault. It was like the other, right. the alternative.
What a lineup. Yeah. I don't think I've ever seen a flyer for that. That's crazy. And all of you are from punk. Every single band on that bill.
Not just all of that, as if that wasn't enough, but Pavement and the Amps with Kim Deal.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. Oh, and the Foo Fighters, not for
and
nothing.
The Foo Fighters on their first, I think their first time in Australia.
Yep. Yep.
They went and shot their video in New Zealand for the This Is a Call, like during that tour. Yeah, it was a crazy bill.
Yeah. That, but like you must have known a bunch of these people, like some of these bands like Bikini Kill and stuff, but like you must have known some of these other people from their pre whatever bands, right? Like Nate had been in Diddley Squad and Sunny Day Real Estate before the Foo Fighters. Like I'm sure like a lot of these people are people you would have seen on the circuit.
I knew William from Foo Fighters. I mean, we were friends. We knew Rancid from the neighborhood.
Yeah.
But no, a lot of them, I mean, I don't know. No. Do I know the Beastie Boys? No. Do I know Pavement or Sonic Youth? No. But it was pretty fun to be around them.
I'm sure.
Yeah, we were starstruck to be in the, you know, on the same stage as all those people. We were like, wow, this is fucking crazy. So I took every opportunity, you know, like I was like, this is a once in a lifetime thing. I'm playing basketball against the Beastie Boys or we're, you know, we had to play Scrabble against Pavement. You know, like we definitely knew that it was like a thing that it wasn't going to happen again anytime soon.
You didn't know Malcolmus from, cause like Malcolmus, what was his punk band? Fuck, I always blank on their name, but he had a punk band.
Stockton band or whatever.
Yeah. You know, the Authorities, I Hate Cops. I Hate Cops. No. They're all about it's like a classic kind of, I guess, Stockton kind of punk record from back then. Maximum Rock and Roll misheard a lyric and gave him a terrible review. But anyway, that was like Malcolmus's like Big Brother's band type thing. And they were the band that kind of like got his punk band going way back when. So, and he was going, he must've seen you guys. Cause he was going to the Gilman for shows. He was telling me he saw NOFX and Op Ivy.
Didn't he tell you that he had the Busy 7-inch or something, Blake?
He did. He passed along a very kind compliment, saying they used to jump around on the couch to that record back at the house.
But this is after
we really didn't know. Yeah. We were new kids in that scene. We were very much the younger ones. You know, it was great though. It was a very friendly. I thought it was just really well done festival. I also got to fly with Lee Ronaldo. We were like aisle mates. It was a two seat aisle, and he just showed me his sandals the whole trip, like from Perth to Adelaide or whatever. He had come like with the express purpose of buying these beautiful sandals that he was like, every time I'm here, I got to get a pair. You know, they're great. That's a cherished memory of mine.
You guys must have seen them though back in New York, right? Like Evol era.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, we're a huge fan. Like I'd see them when I could.
Yeah, we saw them in New York, and we saw them before that. We saw them in LA too, I'm sure.
Yeah, but we weren't we weren't people that talked to bands. Like we didn't go up and right. Not when we were kids. I never wanted to go talk to anybody in band. I wanted to watch them play and get the fuck out of there. I was scared of musicians.
Yeah, I mean it was different then. You didn't really fanboy out. If you did, it was just sort of incidental and kind of like matter of fact. Like no, that whole, you know, no barrier between the guys on stage or the people on stage and the audience. But I didn't go, you know, I wasn't like an autograph hound or anybody. Yeah, I was too shy, I think. I didn't really roll. That was why being on that tour in Australia was like so crazy, because here we were with like some of our favorite bands ever playing with them. I mean, it was crazy. I had to kind of force myself. I was like, I really might have to go say something to Thurston Moore, you know, or tell them that we used to practice at a space in New York, or that, you know, that my sister's Kembra or whatever. I felt I had to do that, you know, just to have sort of an excuse for being there, you know?
See, that's why you guys should have, you know, had the gift of Punisher-itis that I had, which is where you just go up to someone and you just force yourself into the conversation. And you're just like, let's talk about punk. And that, then you eventually get a podcast where you get to do it, and it's no longer just the weird kid at the show doing it.
You're doing great.
I appreciate that. I really do. This has been awesome. And I really got to thank you both for agreeing to come back, because.
Wait a minute. Let me just ask you something before we go away. Are you at a record store? Do you live in a record store?
No, this is how I live, dude.
Because I'm seeing like stacks back there.
Oh, yeah. No, there's like.
Do you have tray cards in there?
Oh, you've got them browsable too, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And divided by country. So this is the world miscellaneous section. And then the Japanese stuff, or these boxes, and some of these ones.
Right on.
But yeah.
Do you think there's any record that I have that you don't have?
The live Jawbreaker record.
Nice callback. I'll see if I got an extra one.
Well, no pressure on that, because, you know, it definitely is now a car payment or two. So
yeah, I could use the $2,000. Yeah. I'm just kidding.
It's amazing how these things become, you know, such cherished artifacts and become like, eventually they're just like cultural touchstones. And I'm, you know, I grew up wanting all these records, and now I'm in a position where I can't afford to buy any of them. So I'm glad I bought them when I did, because like,
yeah. I DJed a set the other night at this bar, at the Kilowatt Bar, right across the street from me. And I just played, my whole set was just 7 inches, which was great because I didn't have to look and try to find the groove.
This is, I just like 45s more than LPs. I got some LPs, but like, for me, it's like a 45, because any band is capable of a great 45. There are a few bands that would get to like one classic LP, let alone a few classic LPs, but there are a lot of great singles out there by a lot of bands that didn't really do much other than that.
I did not take good care of my records. So, I mean, they were really scratchy. It was a little bit embarrassing.
That's weird though, because you were such an archivist too.
Yeah, but I didn't really, you know, I saved stuff, but and hoarded it, but I didn't take great care of everything.
Would you like film stuff? Like, would you take better care of, like, you know, like one sheets or film posters, or certainly DVDs? I imagine you handle with kid gloves.
No, because I had a machine that could fix them.
Yeah.
But I'm precious with my film posters. That's for sure. I've got a really good one sheet collection that I've been amassing since I was a kid. And then certainly at the video store, I would buy them all the time and line the walls with them.
I was looking for a 7-inch to show you, but I can't find it. So I'm that's why I was looking slightly distracted, but I was,
is there one 7-inch that you need to have that you still don't have?
Oh yeah. Like the Fix Vengeance, you know, Fix that was on Touch and Go.
No,
they did 2 7-inches. And there's the one that they only press like 250 of, and fellow Portlandier, Pig Champion, famously went on a road trip to everywhere that they played on a tour to try and find the copies of the 7-inch that they had sent out to these clubs as promos in advance, or copies that anyone had bought. But it goes for like $10,000 now. My friend recently sold his for $10,000 cash. The guy showed up, flew in, handed him a briefcase full of money in the airport, and then just got back on the plane with the record and then left.
Holy shit.
But there's like, there's lots, you know, like I still would love a copy of Unfun on Blue. There's still the Busy 7-inch. There's like a different color of vinyl for that. I've got both versions of the first 7-inch. You know, I had a second press for years and then found a first press. There's like,
what Discord was that? Record. Our first 7-inch?
Yeah, your first 7-inch. Yeah, there's a second press, and then I found a first press copy a couple years ago, and yeah, there's like, you know, it never ends with records. It now ends because I've got kids and I can't afford to buy the records at the prices they're going for. So, well, anytime you guys want to come on here and talk about music, records, art, whatever, you know, the door is always open.
Awesome.
Thank you.